And hopefully, this microphone won't kick off or screw up after 58 minutes. So far, so good. Let me make a couple of comments about the exam. First, the exam will be in this room. We will have two different forms of the exam, the same questions but scrambled and alternating. This simply reduces the temptation to glance over at other people's, the people next to you. Officially, for exams, people are supposed to sit with an empty seat on either side. I think that's not, it's not realistic given the number of seats and the number of people, but in any case, that's the reason why there'll be two different colored exams, but it's exactly the same questions, just a different order. Secondly, there will be a review session that the TAs have organized on Wednesday, 12 to 1:15. That was the time they could get a room that would be big enough for everybody. I know that not everybody will be able to actually attend that review session because you'll have some people will have classes, but the TAs will also be available in their office hours to meet with you before the exam. Just to repeat the kind of general perspective on the exam, it's not a tricky exam, although I'm sure somebody will think that some question is tricky, but at least in my, to the best of my ability, it's an untricky exam, straightforward. You'll be asked to define various concepts that we've been talking about and give examples. That's the guts of the exam, or define particular ideas and give examples of one sort or another. There are five, I believe, questions that are multiple choice that involve data. And some of those will have the feel of being tricky just because I think that's what multiple choice questions virtually always have. The reason why I dislike multiple choice questions is that either you have to make the correct answer completely obvious that anybody could answer it even if they didn't know anything, or you have to make two answers plausible, but just one is correct and one isn't. And if two answers are plausible, then if you don't know it, it seems tricky, right? So it's a problem. It's not easy to do this. I want to show you a particular kind of question so to give you the strategy for how to answer it. This question is not on the exam, but it's an example of a sort of question that could be on the exam. So you have two columns, and you'll have one that says what asks you about what it's like in the U.S. and in some other comparison. So a lot of the data that we've been presenting provides comparisons between the United States and other places. So some people look at this and they just panic. They say, oh my God, how can I do this? The way to do it is to first go down one of them and see which of these possibilities seem about right. Then go down the other column and see which seems about right. And then think about what the point of the comparison was. So on the vacation, on the paid vacation, that came in the lecture on consumption, consumerism, where we talked about, and the chapter goes into more detail about this, about how there's a kind of market failure in leisure. In the United States, we have less leisure than in other comparable countries. So one thing you know is that if you remember that, you'll remember that it's got to be less in the U.S. than in other countries, right? Less paid vacation than in other countries. And it was a lot less. It wasn't just a little less. So this is a lot less. So a bunch of these have less. This one isn't. So you can rule that one out. Then the question is, do you remember roughly the order of magnitude in the U.S. for paid vacations? Well, it's not 6 weeks. You can rule that one out. If you remember at all about what it was in European countries, it'll be one of these two. And then is the average in the United States just under 4 weeks? sort of 3+ weeks paid vacation, or 1 week. So you do it by a process of elimination. This is harder than, the reason I put this up here, because this is harder than any, since we didn't emphasize that. The ones that are, that you'll have comparisons on, are ones that we went over. We didn't go over this one. So there's several different strategies you do. You think about what's the point of the comparison, more in the US or less in the US than other ones. Then you just try to remember the order of magnitudes. Usually that's enough to get you down to a single answer. Sometimes there'll be two that are kind of right, and then if you look at them you have read the material, you should be able to figure out. The five questions that are multiple choice are each only worth 2 points. So it's not a big part of the exam. I think it's probably, I didn't actually add up all the points to see, it's probably about 20% of the exam maybe, something like that. Maybe less even. So most of the exam are the short answer questions. If you have other questions about the exams, check with your TAs. A bunch of people email me, and it's not that I don't want to be accessible, but this is really something that the TAs are fully able to give you advice on. One piece of advice I've given to a number of students who have emailed me, I'll therefore share with you. One is, there's no study guide that I handed out for the exams, but the PowerPoints are kind of like a study guide. You should read them that way. One good way of studying is to find a friend who is not in the class and to explain the PowerPoints to them. You know, you don't have to go through every single one, but if the best way of learning is teaching. And one way to instill the ideas in your own head is to explain them to somebody else. Neurologically, in terms of the way the brain works, partially what happens when you explain it to someone else is the ideas, the issues go into a different part of your memory. You then have the memory both of having heard them in class and having had explained them to someone else. But also you hear yourself. It's why sometimes if you're writing a paper, it's helpful to read out loud to yourself a paper you're writing, because then you'll see how brilliant or how stupid it is. You know, when you hear it, you can identify features of what you're saying that sometimes you can't when you just read it to yourself quietly, you know, silently. So if you explain some of the key PowerPoints to someone else, that actually helps you understand, and it'll also identify where you stumble. You know, you'll realize, can't do it. So explaining it to someone else is a good strategy. I would recommend this as a general strategy for when you take courses where there's a lot of ideas. They're idea-centered courses, as opposed to courses where you're just learning the details of how something is, you know, certain kinds of science courses, where it has the kind of character of this class. Explaining it to somebody else is a really good way. It's often better to do it to somebody who isn't in the class, but you can just pair up with somebody in the class and do this with each other too. That's a good sort of way to study. The exam should take the kind of median person should take maybe 30, 35 minutes on the exam, something like that. Could be 40, somewhere, but well short of the 75 minutes available in the class. The exam will start promptly at 11 on Thursday. And as I said, if it should happen that somebody needs more time than we can have in this room, then the TA will take you back to the social science building and have a place where you can finish the exam. All right. One final thing. As you all know, we canceled last week's lecture. The finance section will now appear at the very end of the next block of courses of the course, the part of the course on inequality and fairness. It's actually not a bad place for it. I think it fits better in this first module of the course, but it's not a bad place because it's kind of a bridge to the question of democracy. finance is a very big part of the economy. It's also a part of the economy that has generated a huge amount of the current inequality we see. It's being generated by finance. That's one of the mechanisms that's producing inequality. And it raises the problem of how finance can be regulated. It's extremely powerful. It has huge consequences, but it's hard to regulate. So it bridges over to the question of how a democratic society deals with centers of power that generate inequality, and whether it should deal with them. So it'll be the last lecture in the next block of the course, and I'll make adjustments accordingly. One final thing. A TA mentioned to me that there are some students in the class who disagree with the kind of central political perspectives, or you could describe it as ideological perspective, that I have in the class, but are frustrated, I hope not because they think I'm mean or anything, but are frustrated because of a sense that I'm just presenting the facts that support my argument. So this raises some really interesting issues about the nature of facts within a social science course, indeed within a science course as well. This isn't just something special to social science, but it's more contentious in sociology. The relationship of facts to arguments, the relationship of the data you present to the arguments. Now, the way I would describe this is not that I am selecting only those facts which fit my arguments, but rather I'm presenting to you what I consider to be the robust, well-established facts about various problems we're studying, and then giving you an interpretation of them that does reflect my theoretical position, but it's not that I've tailored the facts to fit that position. I make arguments based on these facts, and the challenge is, can alternative arguments be made about those facts? The disagreements between political liberals and conservatives are usually, the serious disagreements, are usually less about the facts and more about the interpretation of the facts. I welcome any student who feels that there are alternative facts that would, in fact, present a very different kind of argument, if to present them, you know, to offer them to me. I'm not meaning to bias, to present any kind of bias in the description, the objective factual descriptions that I present, but to give a strong perspective of interpretation with respect to those facts. So I understand the source of the frustration, I think the thing to do about it, if you feel that, is you can certainly come and talk to me about it as well. We can see if we can diagnose where the issues might be. But the thing to do is to come up with alternative data. Now, of course, you can also come up with alternative interpretations. That's the stuff of argument, is alternative interpretations of the same data. But if you think there's a problem in the data itself, then you should raise that with me. Okay. Let's turn now to the last lecture of this block of the course. So here we are at the beginning of the 21st century. We live in an economy that holds up free enterprise and the free market system as a solution to all economic problems. We have deregulated many aspects of economic life. We are a less regulated economy now than we were a few decades ago. And many people believe that whatever problems remaining in the economy would be best served by even less regulation. So we've gradually reduced regulations. We have less of a kind of managed market economy than we had in the past, although the United States never had a strongly regulated capitalist economy, but it's weaker today. And some people believe that it should be even less. We've looked at a number of problems when they are given too much weight, in my judgment, in the way economic activities are organized. We've focused on certain specific commodities, healthcare, for example, And my argument is that the evidence does not support the claim that more markets and more competition produces better health care or cheaper health care, contrary to what some people believe. So some people make this argument, and my view is they're simply wrong. This isn't just a question of perspective. I think it's incorrect that heightened competition in healthcare produces lower costs. In the United States, again, the part of our healthcare system which has the lowest cost, which has the best healthcare outcomes, and the least administrative overhead is the Veterans Administration hospitals. And the Veterans Administration system is the one part of our healthcare system that is directly provided by government. It's state employees. Doctors are not fee-for-service. They are simply employees of the state. And it is the most efficient, high-quality healthcare system in the U.S. And I think those are factual claims. That's not that's the result of studies by organizations that have no political agenda, the Quality Assurance Association, which is concerned with evaluating healthcare. And there are good reasons to understand why competition doesn't accomplish what people think it does, because competition leads to this overinvestment in very expensive technologies and then strong incentives to use them. You know, that was one of the arguments we went through. We examined negative externalities for the environment as another problem that's generated when you don't properly regulate the economy. But the question still remains. These are important topics. The question still remains, well, what about the real heart of the economy? Not these more specialized concerns. What about the core of economic life, the bottom line for many people? Does the free market economy, a relatively unregulated one as we have, does it actually deliver the goods? What does it generate for the income of people? Does it provide for an efficient way for producing most of the goods and services which we consume? Does it basically generate the kind of well-being that and welfare in the sense of the well-being of people, that we would want any economy to provide? So what I'd like to do in this lecture is first just look at the record over the last half century or so. So we'll do a kind of balance sheet. This is what things have been like. And then explore a contrast between two types of capitalism that we could imagine, which Joel Rogers has called high road and low road capitalism. That's a loaded metaphor, needless to say. The metaphor, the highway metaphor, invokes this idea of closing off the low road and paving the high road is the way we should think about the future. These are both capitalisms, by the way. We're not talking about getting rid of capitalism. We're simply talking about two forms of capitalism, which are organized around a similar core idea, private enterprise, but very different relationships of private enterprise to democracy. That'll be the core of the lecture. So, let's do the economic balance sheet. First point, let's just look at average weekly earnings of Americans. The data ends here in 2007. It's gone down since then, since the end of the Second World War. And it's clear from this graph that there's really two basic periods. There's an initial period from the end of the First World War until the early 1970s, a very rapid improvement in the average weekly earnings of people in the United States. Since then, average weekly earnings have remained stagnant. They went down, they've gone up a little bit. They went up a little bit in the 1990s, and they've gone down in recent years again. Strong growth in the decades immediately after World War II, and stagnation and modest decline and stagnation again in the periods since then. Let's look at the same question of growth of income for people at different parts of the income distribution. So this is the bottom 20%, the next 20th 20%, the middle 20%, the top 20%, and the top 5%. In the first 25 years or so, after World War II, I guess the graph is 32 years, income growth was roughly the same across the entire economic spectrum. And if anything, was just slightly higher in the middle. And it was certainly not highest at the top. You know the expression, though, a rising tide lifts all boats. That's a kind of idea that what you want is economic growth because then everybody does better. Well, that's a good description of this 25-year period. Whether you were at the poorest 20% or the richest 20% or even the top 5%, everybody's income was growing at around 3.5% a year, which is a pretty substantial and steady growth rate year on year because, of course, it's compounded. It's 3.5% per year. Look at the next period. It's a totally different picture. You know, something happens. Something happens in the late 70s and early 80s to create a very different dynamic for what happens with economic growth with respect to the income distribution. This is part of the record of American capitalism of the sort we have over the last few decades. In contrast to that earlier period, in the more recent period, economic growth does not rise all boats. A rising tide doesn't lift all boats. It lifts the boats at the top much more than the boats at the bottom. This is a more complicated picture. This is explained in the chapter, but let me just give you the basic point of this. I think it's a pretty interesting picture and pretty fundamental for trying to understand what the hell's going on in the American economy. Productivity is an important concept. You've heard it a lot, I'm sure, if you read the newspapers. The idea of productivity is how much input you need to get a given amount of output, where the amount is measured by the value, the income that's generated, the value of your output. You know, how many hours of labor is needed to produce an automobile? How many hours of labor to produce a television, a computer? A more productive economy is one that needs less inputs for the same output. Now, normally one would think that as productivity rises, that is, as you can produce more and more stuff, more and more value for the same number of hours of work, that's increasing productivity, the same amount of work, more output, you would expect the income of the average person to rise. As the economy becomes more productive, incomes should go up. And that's really what happened for a long period. This starts in 1973 because the time series data for these kinds of things gets quite shaky as you go further back. So this is starting in 1973. The dotted line is productivity growth. The gray line is average compensation. That's just the average annual earnings of people. And the black line is the median compensation. That's the person right smack in the middle. The reason why the average is higher than the median is because the average is skewed to the right. That is, they're very rich people who earn millions of dollars a year. That pushes the average up, but it doesn't affect the person in the middle. Right? So the median for income or earnings is always below the average. The average is always a bit more than the median. But let's look at how this went. For a period into the late 70s and early 80s, productivity and median earnings were kind of tracking each other, and average earnings and productivity were sort of tracking each other. But look what happened somewhere in the early 1980s. We suddenly get this big divergence. Both with average compensation, that's the average earnings of people that they get in their pay, and the rise of productivity, and even a bigger divergence with median earnings and productivity. That means, what it means when productivity goes up much more rapidly than compensation, that the extra dollars that are being generated by that high productivity are not going to the people who are doing the work. They're going to someone else. If they were going to the earners, the people who are doing the work in these firms, then average compensation and median compensation would all move in the same direction. You would not get this increasing gap. The increasing gap comes because an increasing part of the total amount of what we produce, of the value of what we're producing, goes to owners, not to people who are wage earners or salary earners. They go to people who own the capital, and in particular to finance, that's something we'll discuss later, and not to the people who are directly doing the work. This graph shows the relationship between the growth of the median, that's the person in the middle, their compensation and productivity during periods of economic expansion. Periods of economic expansion, when the economy is growing as a whole, that's where you expect especially for productivity and wages to be tied to each other. So if workers are producing more, you'd expect them to be earning more. And that was true in the 1970s, in the period of expansion in the second half of the 1970s. But since then, it has not been true. And it's been increasingly less true. That is, the relationship between productivity, increases in productivity and increasing wages has gotten worse and worse. Here's a graph that reflects some of my own research. Part of my own research in sociology concerns the patterns of job growth. Where are the jobs being created in the economy? And I won't go into the technical details of how I did this, but just think of these as the worst 20% of jobs in the economy and the best 20% of jobs. In the two biggest periods since World War II of job expansion. So if we look at the two periods where we created the most jobs in the last 50 years. One was in the 1960s, and one was in the 1990s. And you can see, these are really two very different worlds. Very different patterns in the nature of the jobs that our economy has generated in this early period, where the job growth was really strong in the middle and weak at the bottom. Jobs were basically being destroyed at the bottom of the economy and being created at the middle and the top. And compare that with the 1990s, the other very big period, 23 million jobs were created in that 8-year period. Very dynamic period of job growth. Again, job growth is high at the top, but not in the middle. The middling kinds of jobs are just not being created. Jobs are being created in low-end retail and in high-end finance and tech and medical services and the like, but not in the middle of the economy. I'm going to skip that one. Here's another kind of balance sheet of our economy going back to the period right after World War II. And this has to do with the relationship of imports to exports. An economy is considered balanced if it has more or less the same amount of same value of products that it's selling to the rest of the world as it's purchasing from the rest of the world. The dotted line are inputs, and the gray line are imports and exports. And the bars represent the balance. So until the late 1970s, there was either a trade surplus or basic balance. That was the general pattern. Since the late 70s, we have been importing increasingly more than we've been exporting. And thus, we have this increasingly negative balance of trade.
Now, a couple of slides about finance. I won't go into details here. This will be for the lecture, you know, in a month or so. Another very big change in the United States over the last 50 years has been in the relationship of finance to the rest of the economy. So without going again into too much detail, you can imagine that the economy can be broken into two very big segments. One is called the real economy. That's where you produce goods and services that people consume. You know, producing automobiles, producing haircuts and restaurants and food. Those are real things that people consume. And another part of the economy involves the buying and selling of assets, which are valuable, assets of one sort or another. Buying and selling a stock. Buying and selling a home mortgage. You're not then in, and that's called the financial sector. You can make profits off of buying and selling stocks, or you can make profits over buying and selling automobiles. Those are two different ways you can make profits. And you can divide the profits in an economy from the profits that are being generated through these direct activities in the production of goods and services that people consume, and profits that are being generated by the trading of assets. The latter are called financial profits. From 1948 until the late 1970s, you can see that this is the percentage of all profits, of all business profits that are can be attributed to the financial sector. What percentage of all the profits generated in American capitalism are generated by banks and investment houses and stockbrokers and mortgage lending, all the different kinds of financial transactions? So you can see it was roughly between 10 and 15% until the late 1970s. And then something changes. And finance becomes an ever greater part of the economy until it reaches over 40%. Over 40% of all profits in the American economy just before the economic crash, over 40% were generated by finance. General Motors, for a period, made more money through the General Motors Acceptance Corporation, which is their lending operation, than they did from the actual sale of the cars. That is, they made more money, more profits, I should say. They made more profits from the loans they gave people to buy cars than they did from the sale of the cars themselves. General Motors would have been a much less profitable corporation, and it was having enough troubles as is. It would have been an even less profitable corporation if people just bought their cars outright. As if people had enough money to just buy the cars without taking out a loan from General Motors, General Motors would have been a much less profitable corporation. It was making most of its profits from loans, not from the sale of the cars themselves. Finally, this shows just the general relationship between the profits in the non-financial sector and the financial sector. And as you can see, the rate of profit, this is, and I believe what 100 is set at, does it say here? Well, I believe 100 is probably set around 1980 here, but I'm not sure. But you can see that the two track each other very closely until sometime in the 1980s, where the profits from financial in the financial sector zoom up and diverge tremendously from the profits in the non-financial sector. This is the economic crash where the profits in the financial sector collapsed, but they bounced right back up. So almost immediately after the crisis in 2009 and 10, the rate of profit in the financial sector was pretty much back to where it was, as roughly 40% of all profits. So what should be done? And are these problems? Well, I think these are problems. I think
the financial performance, the economic performance of the United States over the last 25 years has not benefited most people, and that's a problem. I think having an economy whose profits are being generated not by producing goods and services but by selling assets is a problem. I think a trade deficit in which we are unable to produce things that other places in the world want as much as we want what other people produce is a problem. The question then is what can be done about this? And again, to quote Joel Rogers' quip, we should close off the low road, pave the high road, and help firms and workers move from the first to the second. So here's what I'm going to do now. I'm going to give you a table. This is a table that's in the book, so you don't need to take notes on the table itself. It's in the book, and it's in the PowerPoints that you can download. I'm going to give you a table that contrasts these two types of capitalism. This will be a contrast between this stylized idea of a low road and a high road, two different kinds of capitalism. And then I'm going to talk about the problems of moving from one to the other. If we're on the low road, what is the problem of shifting to the high road? I will also be going through this table pretty quickly, partially because it's, I think, pretty carefully explained in the book, and what I have to say is pretty much the same thing as what's in the book. But also I want to leave at least a little time to talk about these obstacles to transformation. Okay, first, what's the basis of competition among firms? Low-road capitalism is characterized by competition primarily on the basis of price. The way you compete is by selling the same thing for less cost. High-road capitalism competition is primarily based on quality. It's not that price is irrelevant. It's not that it's irrelevant, but that the main thing that makes you more competitive is that you produce something better than other people. In contemporary markets, Apple Computer is considered the paragon of a firm that competes primarily on quality. They certainly don't compete on price. You know, the comparable products by other manufacturers, other computer companies, are cheaper. The reason why people buy Apple products is because they value the quality and are prepared to pay more for it. Sometimes, of course, the quality is mythic. It's quality that's created in the minds of consumers, but nevertheless, in general, I think in the Apple case, one can say that the quality has been high and that that's the basis of its competition. So high-road capitalism are firms that are concerned with the quality of what they produce. So quality control becomes extremely important. Low-road firms compete primarily on price. The nature of the products. Low-road capitalism is mainly built around mass production of homogeneous products. Homogeneous means they're the same. They don't vary a great deal. Whereas high-road capitalism is based on competition over specialized and customized goods that are finely tuned to the particular needs and preferences of people. The typical jobs in low-road capitalism can be described as highly specialized, whereas the typical jobs in high-road capitalism are multitasked and much less specialized. Skills. By the way, just to remind you, I'm giving you what's called a stylized contrast, right? So I'm making this more extreme. Of course there's overlap. It's not as simple as this. But the reason for giving this stylized contrast between what sociologists call ideal types, that's pure types of the extreme, is that it clarifies the character of these two alternatives. it gives you some grounding for then studying the complexity of actual firms. So on skills, the characteristic of low-road capitalism is low skill, the skills. It's what, at the beginning of the 20th century, the industrial engineer, the work time specialist Frederick Taylor referred to as trained guerrillas. The idea was to create systems of mass production of homogeneous goods with very well-specified tasks that a trained guerrilla could do it. Whereas high-road capitalism is based on high skills, lots of training. And above all, the high-road capitalism is based on what I described in an earlier lecture, if you remember, when we were first talking about public, when we were talking about public goods, I gave the example of the public goods of training. High-road capitalism is really characterized by the training of meta skills, which are transferable across jobs. One of the hallmarks of the kind of edgy part of the computer and software industry in California is that software engineers move from job to job a lot. They don't stay working for the same firm for very long. They're constantly on the lookout for job shifts. And they can do it because there's such a density of employers in the same area that they can change jobs without having to move to a different place. They can just shift around among different employers. They're able to do that because they have meta skills. If they just had the specialized skill needed for the particular job they held at Google, then they couldn't easily shift to Apple. If they had meta skills, the skill at learning skills, this high level of flexible capacity, then they're valuable employees that can quickly adapt and learn the new things they need to learn in a new job. Low-road capitalism involves training that is very job-specific, concerned with the concrete tasks that a particular person has to do in a particular firm. The skills that are trained in low-road capitalism are not very portable. They're very job-specific. The training process in low-road capitalism is a short job training provided by the employer, whereas the training for high-road capitalism is lifetime training and retraining provided by both employers and government, both through universities and training institutions of various sorts and by the employers. Job autonomy in low-road capitalism is low, whereas it's high in high-road capitalism. People monitor themselves more than are monitored by foremen in high-road capitalism. Much more reliance on self-direction. Hierarchy in low-road capitalism is rigid, with a sharp differentiation between managers and workers and many managerial layers. That's the kind of classic image of the corporation. Top-down authority goes from top to bottom. People do what they are told. Whereas in high-road firms, there's low differentiation of managers and workers with relatively few layers and a great deal of mobility between workers and managers and informal interaction and dialogue between them. And finally, on wages, low-road capitalism is rooted in relatively low wages. High-road capitalism is rooted in relatively high wages. These alternatives have tremendous consequences for the lives of people. In the context of global competition, low-road strategies, if you have firms that are trying to compete globally on the basis of just price competition, that's the centerpiece of their competition, this leads to low wages, wage cuts, and outsourcing of jobs. If price is the main thing you're going to compete on, then you're going to want to produce in the part of the world where the wages are lowest. So outsourcing of jobs is one of the consequences of low-road
strategies of competition. Whereas if you're in a high road firm, you're very concerned with how you can continually improve quality and productivity by creating a density of social institutions and supports in your economic environment that will support the development of meta skills, flexible workers, and so on. This has, of course, obvious consequences for the lives of people who work in such firms in terms of work life, the quality of work, the degree of alienation, the sense of meaning and purpose of workers, but also, of course, in terms of their wages. This, then, is a stylized characterization of two ways in which capitalist enterprises can be organized. Now, of course, in actual capitalist societies like the United States, many firms combine these. So there's some firms that we think of as primarily low-road firms. Walmart would be an example. Walmart is an example of a firm which pretty closely tracks these characteristics. Very low skill, low wage, high turnover, rigid hierarchy, strict monitoring and control of employees. Competition on price, the low price leader. That's the whole sales pitch of Walmart. But we also do have firms in the United States that are high road firms. Google is a high road firm. Google is a kind of fantasy firm in some of its sites in terms of the quality of work life, the amount of recreational time, the lack of supervision. People come and go when they want. They work on projects. Google allows people in some of its divisions to work on projects which they concoct that aren't given from above. I mean ordinary software people can, as a group, decide, yeah, let's try this, and they get permission to try all sorts of things that are not part of the standard agenda. There's a sort of feeling that if you have a more freewheeling environment of innovation and autonomy, in the end, even if it's not efficient in the short term, it'll be efficient and profitable in the long term. Well, that's true because the whole culture and structure of the firm is organized around these high road principles. These are alternative paths. We could imagine a future for the American economy which continues to pursue the low road or shifting towards a high wage, high skill alternative. You can see from the graphs that we looked at with stagnant wages and increasingly polarized economy that the low road is alive and well in the United States. Both are possible and both are consistent with profitability. The question then is, why would anybody prefer the low-skill mass production option? You'll rarely find anybody defending that option. Nobody's going to say, yes, what I see as my vision for America for the 21st century is an economy of low-skill, low-wage workers under rigid hierarchies of managerial control. Nobody says that. But the actual practice of a great deal of the American economy is precisely oriented towards that kind of economic relation. So let me give you then some theoretical ideas that help to understand why it's not so easy to shift from one of these courses of development to another. This graph shows the relationship between the skill level of workers and the profits of firms. If you're on the left of the curve, small increases of skill do not actually increase profits. So if you're in the left part of the curve, if you're basically located here and you just improve your skills a little bit, it doesn't increase profits. If you're on this part of the curve, that is, if you're a firm, this shows the skill levels of workers in a firm and the profits of the firm. If you're basically organized as a low-road firm and you start providing more training for workers, that training is a cost, But simply increasing the skills a bit of your workers just pushes you a little bit. And it makes it actually less profitable. Whereas if you're in this part of the curve, and you figure out ways to increase the skills of your workers, it pushes you to the higher profitable level. So the problem is, how do you go from here to here? Well, that's a problem because you have to jump. You have to go through this valley. That's what's called a transition trough. A transition trough. Now, this is a, you know, this is a complicated idea. I think it's a really important general problem that encounters all sorts of efforts at social change, and particularly concerns problems if you really want to change some certain key elements in an economy. This will always be a problem, the transition trough. The basic idea is this: some things that will make the system work better in the long run make it work worse in the short run. We have some expressions, they're folk expressions, one step backwards for two steps forward. You know, sometimes you have to retreat in order to advance. Sometimes you have to reduce your rate of profit in order to increase it in the future, because you have to engage in investments that have no short-run payoff. And that's because if you're here and you want to start re-engineering and redesigning your economic institutions, or either within a firm or within a broader context, to move from here to here, you have to somehow survive the process by which you're increasing skills but reducing profits, until you get to the point where you've increased skills enough and done all the other things that define the high road with all these other aspects of the institution, that suddenly you get the synergies. This, by the way, was something observed when computers first became a regular part of many capitalist firms. Initially, investments in computers did not increase profits, much to everybody's surprise. Everybody thought computerization would immediately raise profits. It turned out it didn't. It took a while before adding all this new capital equipment, a new kind of way of processing information, was complemented by all sorts of other changes in the organizations of capitalist firms, that suddenly they would produce a much more productive economic system and therefore generate higher profits. So the first problem is the transition trough. If we're on the high road, this is the low road. If we just stay on it, this is our future. And this graph is the ability to compete in international competition. If we go on the low road, in the long run we can't survive. We cannot compete effectively in the long run internationally on the low road, because the wages are so much lower elsewhere in the world. So competing on the low road is a recipe for long-term decline. If at this point we decide to switch, a firm says, okay, enough of this, I want to move to the high road, the problem is initially things get worse. Eventually they get better and you're in a much better position to compete globally if you're a high road firm than a low road firm. But to get from here to here, you have to go to here. Now that's a general problem. And the question then is, can a firm actually survive that trap, that valley? Can they actually make that transition? Well, what happens? Suppose you're a corporation and you're selling your stock on a stock market. What happens when you start this downward trajectory? Your rate of profits go down. You become a less desirable investment. If the time horizons of investors is really short, if investors are saying, what's the rate of return in the next quarter, in the next year? People start selling your stock. Your stock goes down. The value of your corporation goes down. It becomes harder then to borrow the capital needed to invest in the new technologies and training programs and the like that would enable the firm to survive this transition trough. So the problem then is, and that's why this is what would be called a structural problem. It's not really a question just of bad faith or of bad ideas or of stubbornness. The problem is that there are real costs to transformation if you're already on one course and you want to change. To go from the low road to the high road between those two columns of that stylized picture means you have to accept a lower rate of profit for some length of time. Now, this picture is very neat, right? This is all clear, nice dashes and solid lines. Of course, when you're at this point in the curve, you don't see the future. The future is just a hypothesis. What investors see is just dropping profits. And they hear the reassurances of the progressive, ambitious CEO saying, just wait, just wait, just wait. In 2 years, in 5 years, we'll be back in a competitive position. And people are skeptical. So that's part of this complexity. There's uncertainty in the future. In the present, you see profits declining. If you realize all this uncertainty, then you say, well, maybe it's better to stick on the low road. At least we'll survive for a while. Now, there is a way out of this. You know, if you have public support, if we as a community, as an economy, as a democracy, if we recognize that we want a high road future, not a low road future, some of the costs involved in this transition can be borne by everybody, not just by the firm. So if one of the big costs in going from the low road to high road is training, one way of making it easier for firms to shift is to, as a collective, as a community, as a democracy, to invest a lot in training, to invest a lot in creating meta skills, and not to have that be primarily the responsibility of the employers themselves. If we do that, then there still will be a transition trough, but it will be more shallow. A lot of what's called industrial policy or economic policy, subsidies, a lot of that, the real meat and potatoes of what's going on, is trying to make the transition costs to firms less. But it's very hard to see how that can happen without a very active role for democratic institutions, for the government. It's very hard to see how that's going to happen spontaneously in the market because of the imperatives of short-term profits that the market imposes on firms. Okay, that's the first problem, what can be called the transition cost trap. The second problem we've already talked about, so I won't go through this in any detail here. It's basically the problem of the training deficit trap. This was in our discussions of the free riding problem. It's one of the best examples, I think, of prisoner's dilemmas. Individual employers are skeptical of providing extensive general training for these meta skills because when they do so, their employees can always jump ship and go to another employer. So as long as some employers are prepared to poach other employers' employees, then these other employers can avoid paying the costs of training and still get the good workers. And that creates this training deficit trap, which we discussed earlier. There's a third issue, which is considerably, I think, more controversial. The transition cost for modernizing and upgrading skills and technologies and creating more advanced manufacturing, that part of the argument about de-skilling and skill enhancement, that part of the argument, I think, is not so controversial. There may be controversies as to whether or not government can be effective in doing anything about it. Some people might say, yes, there's this transition trough for government firms that want to go on the high road, but government is just going to mess it up. They just are incompetent. The government can't achieve its goals, and therefore it's better not to try. That's a critique of the competence of government to solve this problem, but not that there is a problem that needs solving.
With respect to the role of unions in this process and how the active collaboration of workers in solving problems might be helpful, this is a more controversial problem itself. Not everybody even thinks this is an issue. Indeed, many people think the world would be much, much better if there weren't unions at all, if workers simply sold their skills on a labor market without being involved in any collective organization of other workers. We'll be talking about unions more systematically in the discussion of democracy. So this is, in a way, just foreshadowing some of the ideas that we'll be thinking about there. So here's the basic idea. Let me just explain how to think about this problem. Certain kinds of reorganization of work requires a high degree of stable cooperation and trust between labor and management. Both sides need to be collectively organized to solve the problems they face. And collaboration between labor and management is easier when there's a lot of trust between them. And there's a more likely to be trust between workers and managers when workers individually feel that they're protected by collective organization. A strong anti-union orientation by employers makes it harder to generate the long-term confidence and cooperation between labor and management needed for a successful reorganization of production in these high road ways. Now, as long as you want to stay on the low road, then unions are a pain in the ass, and getting rid of unions is a good strategy. If you want to compete on price, and the key imperative is how can we minimize wage costs, how can we lower the price of labor, unions are clearly a problem. So if we look at this is another one of these graphs. This kind of shape of a graph, this sort of shape that starts down and then bends up, is called a curvilinear shape. This is sometimes referred to as a, if it's symmetrical, it's called a U-shaped curve. In this case, it's not symmetrical. This is sort of a reverse J. So here's the basic idea. On this axis, we have the strength of worker organizations and participation, which can go from very low, that's where individual workers simply sell their labor to an employer. They have no organization on the shop floor and no organization in the labor market. In that situation, sometimes people say workers are atomized. They're like atoms, just bouncing off of each other. Individualized, atomized workers. That's at the low end of strength. At the high end of strength, you have workers collectively organized in unions in the labor market, so they shape the conditions under which the labor is sold. The nature of the contracts are bargained between a collective of workers. And in the workplace, they're organized into worker councils, into various kinds of teams that are involved in collective problem solving with employers, rather than just separate, isolated individual employees. That would be at the other extreme. Now, the United States today is somewhere on this part of the curve. We have a relatively de-unionized labor force. Well under 10% of private sector workers are now in unions. If we wanted to look at the future, there are then two directions that we could go. Continuing on the low road would suggest we should attack even the weak unions we have and move in this direction. If we want to move to the high road, where there's much more collaboration and balance of power between labor and capital, in deciding how to move and restructure the economy, so there's much more of a collaborative process rather than an antagonistic one, then we have to move in this direction. Well, you can see why that's a problem. If for union, for the strength of working class organization to go from its current situation
to a point on this curve where they could positively add to the productivity and the collective collaboration within economic organizations, you have to go through this trough again. It's a bit like the skill problem. To go from a low skill to a high skill form of organization requires surviving a transition trough. And one of the reasons, therefore, why there's such strong resistance to unions by employers in the United States and such continual pressure to dismantle and attack even the weak unions we have is precisely because we're located at this part of the curve rather than located at this part of the curve. And that also then impedes our ability to move from the low road to the high road. Well, what to do about this? I think all three of the problems that I've identified, so these are three problems that obstruct the movement from the low road to the high road, that prevent us from reconstructing American capitalism on this high productivity, high skill, flexible work regime. There are three problems I identified: transition cost traps, the training deficit trap, and the anti-unionization trap. All three of these problems, traps as I've called them, require an active affirmative state in order to be solved. None of these problems can be solved by relying exclusively on market forces. Indeed, some of these problems are themselves intensely generated by the very market forces on which people, some now say, or many people now say, we need to rely. The transition cost trap, the trap that's caused by the problem of how do you modernize and reorganize production in such a way as to emphasize this high training meta-skill regime to move from the low road to the high road. The transition cost trap can only be solved, I would argue, if there is significant public involvement in subsidizing the transition costs, perhaps even paying entirely for the transition costs. I have no, this might seem strange, I have no problem with what's sometimes called corporate welfare, that is, government subsidies to corporations, so long as it's government subsidies of the sort that enable the economy to work better in the interests of all of its citizens. And subsidizing capitalist firms is one of the things that has to happen when you face these problems. Tax breaks, tax credits, direct subsidies to modernize production, new forms of government, public-private partnerships around training, lifelong learning centers for workers where they can go for retraining. All of these sorts of things require resources. The basic way to get such resources is through taxation and spending those taxes to reduce the transition costs faced by firms would be one way of encouraging the economy over time to move from the low road to the high road. But this, of course, requires what I'm calling an affirmative state, and an affirmative state which has broad popular support. And that's only possible if people are willing to fund such activities, that is, through taxation. Second problem, the training deficit trap. This also cannot be solved without extensive public involvement in training. There just is no way that an unregulated labor market in training is going to provide meta skills for workers. Now, it will for a very small segment of workers. Very high-end software engineers will develop meta skills, although those meta skills are also generated substantially through public institutions, through education. But if we want an economy in which the vast majority of the labor force have meta skills, we can only do this by having public involvement, heavy public involvement in the provision of training. This doesn't mean that it has to be provided in ordinary schools. It can be provided in training centers that have heavy involvement of employers as well. There has been an experiment over the last 15 or 20 years in Milwaukee in the metalworking sector to have essentially training centers or training processes around meta skill formation in the metalworking sector, which is a small firm sector in Milwaukee, organized collaboratively with the involvement of employers, the technical training system, and labor unions in Milwaukee. And it's been pretty successful. It's called the Wisconsin Regional Training Partnership. It's an unusual example of a public-private partnership for the solving of one of these economic traps. And finally, the anti-unionization trap can only be solved by a change in legal rules that actually makes it easier for people to form unions. The United States, as we'll see when we discuss unions more directly, has the most restrictive rules about forming unions of any democratic capitalist economy. We have in the rules of the game that people have to play by in order to form unions the most anti-union environment against the free association of people to pursue their interests. All right, I hope all goes well on Thursday, and I'll see you next week.